interviewing the leading private equity executives and unlocking the secrets of success. Welcome to the Private Equity Podcast with Alex Rawlings.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Private Equity Podcast. Joining us today is Pari Natarajan, CEO and co-founder of Zenov, a global management and strategy consulting firm working with private equity companies. Welcome, and thank you very much for sharing your insights with us, Pari.
Thanks, Alec. Thanks for the invite.
Excellent. So, as is customary, if you could give us a 60 to 90 second breakdown of you, please.
Hi, I'm co-founder and CEO of Zenov. We are a management consulting firm. We work with private equity firms in helping them in deal sourcing, help them in due diligence, as well as build out value creation plan for the portfolio companies. Our specialty is in tech and tech services companies. Private equity who are only focused on this area or have one of the themes is tech and tech services. We work with both the private equity as well as the limited partners.
So what's one mistake that you see either private equity firms or portfolio companies making, and what action would you suggest to correct them, please?
That's a heavy question right now. I think that's the big issue right now is a whole lot of uncertainties, and the private equity are looking to buy companies, are looking for the valuation to go down, and the private equity are looking to sell their companies, want to retain the valuation to the level what it was last year. So it's kind of like the same companies, the expectation from what they sell and what they buy, it's a bit different. So they need to really look at, instead of looking at the valuation comparison, really look at the fundamentals of the company and see over the next 4 to 5 years, how do we unlock value in the companies, right? And just going back to basics and looking at the fundamentals and analyzing the company, I think that's going to be very important, especially in this period of uncertainty, very difficult to, you know, set price targets.
Okay, interesting. And you mentioned, obviously, we are in a period of uncertainty. Where's, based on your research, support firms of due diligence and deal origination, et cetera, where are you seeing or where would you suggest that private equity firms should be investing in 2023?
What we see is private equity firms should be focused on areas which provides more recurring revenue streams. And because the cost of debt is starting to increase significantly, has already increased. And it's difficult also for them to raise debt. Interest rates are very high. So how do you not think about any business which has a higher free cash flow as well as recurring revenue? It's going to be important. So kind of obvious, right? But how do you now look at your transformation levers around that? For example, in technology, if you're buying a company which is largely on-prem, and transforming that into a subscription and then to a SaaS business, or provides you a recurring revenue stream so they can predict what the revenue is going to be over a period of time. Similarly, even if you're buying an industrial product company, but how do you build more services revenues on top of the product you build to sell? So once the product is sold, there are additional service revenue, which is more recurring, but you're able to sell more into those accounts, become very critical. That's a second. And third is where in industries and companies where they have higher level of opportunity with their existing customers. What we see during recessionary times is companies want to consolidate with their large partners or vendors and then reduce the long tail. So you really have to figure out how would you grow your existing customer revenue and not so rely so much on net new customer revenue. So looking at that aspect, and which are the companies which have higher addressable, total addressable market by existing customer, that's going to be another lever for private, to look at. Right? It could be in any industry, it could be in healthcare, could be insurance, could be in software and other areas.
That's interesting. When we think of the term recurring revenue, and obviously the SaaS model has that software as a service platform, we immediately think tech. We immediately think, okay, yeah, well, that's tech investing. And I don't do that. Now, you mentioned industrials there and the service element. What, have you helped kind of companies making that transition and supporting them with driving more service capability and going from just general manufacturing to then also that service element into a business?
Correct. Think of two kinds of service capability, right? One, a Gillette or a HP printer. And once they sell the printer or sell the, you know, your razor, the money they make is selling the blades or, in the scenario, ink cartridge in an HP printer. So there, you're able to construct a service business around the product itself. So that's one way in which you can structure that. Second is where you're moving one level higher in the value chain and figuring out, is there a way, can I, instead of selling a product, can I become a system integrator? So that I'm just going and solving a specific problem for the customer and building a solution. And part of the portfolio of the solution is your own product, but the remaining is coming from other vendors. You're integrating the product. And then you have a managed service contract on managing that solution for a period of time. So building a consulting and service system integration capability on top of your product lines. The second one is an existing product line. How do you convert some of it into a subscription? So it's similar to what a SaaS company does, but in more physical products.
Interesting. And we spoke about, you mentioned about tech. So look at like private equity firms. Why should they be capitalizing on that digital side? And also, you mentioned the recurring revenue model in the tech kind of sphere. What on the side from recurring revenue model makes the tech industry attractive and recommended by yourselves?
Yeah, and if you've seen the last 2 years, right, the technology adoption of companies have dramatically increased. And then when tech companies are deployed in a particular, a manufacturing company or an insurance company, what is called a system of records, right? The entire business is now run on this particular product. So let's say somebody is deploying an SAP system or Oracle system. It becomes very mission critical for you to run the business. So it's very difficult for you to remove that and add another software on top of it. So software is becoming more and more mission critical, and every company, be it a small business to some of the largest companies in the world, are relying on software. So that's a macro trend. And the second macro trend, once you get in, it's very difficult for a company to remove the software. That's why you build a moat around your capability, because you're deeply integrated into the organizational's workflows, how the company does business. And then the third part is, how it's moving into more recurring streams. And the fourth is, when large companies want to build their own technology, there is a massive labor shortage. So it's very difficult for them to attract and build strong technology teams internally. So what they're doing is they're outsourcing the technology development to tech services companies like Accenture. So it's private equities are looking at, how do I now identify the next generation of Accenture and invest in them? And at these companies scale, because customers are now going to be able to build all of the technology inside, they got to rely on these partners to build technology services. So in a combination, both technology software, enterprise software areas, where it becomes system of workflow, mission critical, really high reliance of the customer on you, as well as in tech services, where you're helping customers build a technology by giving a set of consultants. Both are the macro trend, as both industries are going to grow over the next several years. So if the private equity are going in, they can make these businesses a lot more efficient, but it's not just an efficiency game. It's also about growth. So there is a term you would have heard about called Rule of 40. A Rule of 40 is, it's a combination of your revenue growth as well as your EBITDA growth. That's Rule of 40, right? And right now, software companies are operating at about Rule of 50, a Rule of 60. So there's so much opportunity in terms of both growth as well as your profitability, and makes it very interesting for our private equity companies to invest in.
Okay, interesting. And I just want to talk about the tech space a little bit, because I think it was explained very well by me, and I can't remember who it was that explained it to me. But what they explained is that technology is really an industry. Technology is in every industry. It just disrupts, and it's not a standalone sector. It's a part of every single sector. So I think a lot of firms think, well, we're an industrial firm, we're a food manufacturing company, we don't use technology. But if you went back to, let's say, a food manufacturing company, and everybody's having to slice hand by hand the chicken or whatever else, or whatever it is you're producing, and having to make the cans by hand, we're using technology, and we've seen that technology disruption in earlier phases. We just don't see it as technology anymore. We just see it as CapEx equipment, etc. What's your kind of message to companies that maybe think, we're not really in the technology game, we're in the industrial game, we're in the food manufacturing game, or healthcare game to an extent? What's your kind of message to them about utilizing technology, whether that be actually in the private equity firm or in the portfolio company?
Correct. So there are, you know, three or four dimensions. We call it Digital Transformation 2.0. It's really about providing, one is your productivity and operational efficiency, but also providing an integrated experience around your employee, your customer and partners. So let's take a simple thing in a manufacturing company, the order to cash process. You're going to pay your vendors on time. And when you're going into a negotiation with your vendors again, if you pay your vendors on time, your supply chain on time, you get a better leverage in negotiating with them. Because payment on time is a huge issue in this industry. But if you're able to inject artificial intelligence in your order to cash process and then automate the workflows and provide high level, that what will that allow is it'll provide high level of transparency to vendors on when they could get paid, and ensure that they're able to get paid in the right time and not constrained by your organizational process issues. So if you can use automation and AI, you're able to optimize your order to cash. Then you're able to get an experience of your customers better. Similarly, your employee experience, right? How do you ensure that your employee lifecycle, from the time you're able to identify who they are and bring them on board, train them, engage them, and manage your alumni network, there is now technology possibility across the value chain. How do you drive it to provide better employee experience? And the third part is, you know, a lot of these companies, right, if it's in Ford or in other industry area, they have a whole lot of data around customer, but they don't know what to do with this data. What technology is allowing them is to provide a unified view of each of the customer, so that they have a deeper understanding of what the customer is looking for and provide proactive resolution of issues, are able to sell additional value for the customer. So it allows you in increasing your revenue potential per customer. In some areas, we are figuring out, like, for example, retail companies. They now look at Amazon and others. Hey, Amazon is making so much of money in ads. And ads, if you think about ad revenue, it all goes into your margins. I'm not spending anything. I'm just showing ads when you're searching for something. So how do I provide very similar experience in my physical stores? Is that a way for me to be more intelligent in injecting ads into my physical store? Because all of that is going to feed into my margin. So there, they're losing data, but also creating new revenue stream using in technology. So all of this, you know, significantly will improve not just your operational improvement, but also your experience of customer. And we are just touching the technology such as generative AI, right? I think of generative AI is going to make a massive difference in terms of how your marketing team is creating content, or your leadership is in terms of engage with people. So a lot of productivity of more higher end white collar workers will also be impacted by the new generation of AI. So there's huge potential both for private equity companies in optimizing the company they buy using technology, or even traditional large, you know, publicly traded companies can use this technology to drive significant efficiency. I think we're just getting started in those areas.
Yeah, that's interesting. Sorry to interrupt here. Just a quick note to highlight our new sponsor, Grafter. The private equity market is rapidly shifting to a data-driven, proprietary deal sourcing standard. Grafter provides the window into over 7 million middle market private companies. Contact Grafter so you can access the market first. Request a demo, www.grafter.com. Now back to the podcast. So AI is a bit of a really interesting subject. We listened to Elon and we're well into AI, and well, there's a lot to go, but we're obviously, he's seeing a lot more of what's actually happening with artificial intelligence. And, you know, we've seen ChatGPT burst onto the scene and then all these subsequent businesses that have kind of blown around that. And, you know, for a lot of people, well, it's a bit like a Google, well, it's a bit like this. What do you foresee kind of in AI? Well, is there any areas of AI that you can kind of foresee disrupting certain elements, whether that be within certain industries, within any industry, obviously, that's this private equity back, which covers everything. But what are you seeing specifically from AI that, if I'm listening, I'm thinking, God, I'm sick of hearing about AI, I don't really get it. And yeah, I get it, is robots are going to take over the world. But what are we actually seeing from an AI perspective, aside from ChatGPT?
Correct.
What do you have to see?
Yeah, I think AI is a lot more basic than that, right? So we think of AI into, you know, three key, you know, buckets. The first bucket is just AI helping in automating your manual process. let's say, for example, you know, you have a document, right? And the document has to be, somebody has to read the document and enter the document into their workflow system. AI is able to understand natural language better and able to translate the document much better compared to having more complex rule-based engines before. The rule-based engine, for example, you have 20 templates of data coming into a company. It could be a loan origination form, or it could be a customer KYC, or some other invoice document which is coming in. Right now, AI is able to interpret that information and digitize that information. So that's one which used to be done by manual workforce sitting in information that could be some offshore location. That is being automated. That's a huge, high value, huge productivity improvement for companies. The second part of AI is inference. Now we have got this data, we have digitized it, we have all of this data. How do I infer? For example, you know, you are underwriting a loan. Can I use AI to augment the human judgment on how to underwrite the loan? And AI is providing that. That's an inference system, what we call a system of intelligence. That's a second wave of AI. And the third wave of AI is more sort of experience, where AI is allowing you to create content. When you're creating content, it's disrupting, you know, a public relations job or a marketing job or even a job of a customer support agent who is resolving a particular issue for a customer. So that's in terms of creation of content and also delivering on an action, right? The second part is inference. Hey, you know what you should do, but AI is now starting to create new workflows in the company and starting to get things done. So you don't have to go into a human agent to get things done. So if you look at these three aspects, there is significant value in all three dimensions of AI. For example, if a private equity company is buying a consumer-focused company in any industry, be it in retail, be it in insurance and other data. Now, the significant amount of money is spent in customer service. You can use technology to completely automate it so that the robots are able to solve the customer issue and reduce the number of human touch points, which reduces the overall cost, but also improves the customer experience. So that's a huge benefit, you know, what they could get, right? Or they are, like I said, they can manage, optimize order to cash process and standardize the process for all the company they are buying. To think of a private equity firm having a center of excellence around automation and AI. And that's a central function what they create. So any company they buy, they're able to, the center of excellence is allowing them to optimize specific corporate functions. That's a huge value. It's both in terms of across the three dimensions, as well as how you can operate. You need to have the right partnership. Then the private equity firm should also have partnership with consulting companies, partnership with tech services companies, as well as partnership with platform like Google and others. So you're able to stitch that together for every company they buy so that every portfolio company doesn't have to go and figure this out themselves.
Interesting. Really interesting. So we talked a lot about that. Was my interpretation of value creation is basically what we've discussed. I feel that value creation is an overused term nowadays. And I think if I was in a founder position and I was looking to enter into private equity, I'd be sick of hearing about how they can create value in an organization. A, what's your interpretation as you work with private equity firms to drive value creation? What's your interpretation of value creation? And B, what area do you think that private equity firms need to dive a little bit deeper on with their portfolio companies that they're potentially missing with this value creation area?
Yeah. So if you take private equity business, right, compared to a VC business, if you think about two different businesses, because we also work with VCs. Okay. The VC business is about, you know, home runs. I will invest in 10 companies and each of those companies I'm going to swing. One of them becomes hit and 9 of them fails, I'm okay. That's the business model. In a private equity business model, I'm going to hit 10 and all 10 has to be successful, but I can steal a single here and so on. So for them, it's a business model very, very different. So they don't want to take a lot of risk on the company they buy, which limits what could be done on value creation. If you think about value creation, one aspect is about optimizing costs. That's pretty standard, right? I'm deploying technology, I'm deploying AI, I'm moving things to offshore, I'm simplifying the organization structure. You can do a few things which would reduce overall cost, right? You can lay off a certain set of manager. You can take out two layers. If you're buying a public company, you're moving them private, just removing two layers will give you savings. But then you need to also focus on growth. And that's where they struggle. For growth, they want to be certain about growth. That's very hard, right? Growth is about taking a portfolio risk. So you have to have, okay, I want to try 4 different experiments. One of those is going to work. I don't know which one is going to work. And I need to get it to market using more a lean startup and getting a product market fit and then scaling that. So for private equity, should have a slight, even though they don't want to take a major risk like VC, but from a growth perspective, growth thesis should be based on portfolio of ideas and how do I manage the portfolio of ideas and bet on one of those for each company. That many of them, many of them come from a cost optimization, operational improvement, thesis of value creation. Now they're starting to think about growth, especially the last lot more companies are focused on growth. Now they are going back to their basics with the decision. But I think more and more companies will start to change how they think about growth going forward.
Interesting. And gross. I mean, growth, well, you said growth's a risky business. And I'd agree with you there because you're going a little bit into the unknown. Why specifically do you think the private equity firms fear that kind of growth element? Is it because of the risk nature or, you know, and then being particularly risk averse? Why do you think that we're now moving towards that, whereas previously we've been, you know, how do we restructure a business in essence?
Correct. It's really about how they think about risk, right? They are looking for certainty in a business. Like growth, by definition, it's uncertain because you don't know where the growth is going to come from and different areas. And also another one is just sort of how you invest in growth, because you have high debt in some of the company and you need to service the debt over a period of time. And your ability to invest in growth is also limited because of the debt you have on the companies and the fact that you need to pay it off. Right now, the interest rate are higher. You want to do this faster. Right? A combination of that, one is uncertainty, another one is the structure of the deal itself. Right? So a combination of that is an issue. You know, some of the companies we are talking to right now, they're doing a little bit different, right? Because there's so much of dry powder. So you're putting in a lot more equity. So the debt on the company is lower. And then you make it a platform and you go and buy growth. So that's something companies are very interested in. So can I make these a platform company? Can I go buy growth and buy these smaller companies? And the platform has strong processes, strong systems, strong leadership, and able to integrate the company which they buy quickly. Before, it's all about, you know, you buy a company, you integrate. You don't really integrate it that well because you want the acquired company also should have some say in terms of when they get the upside, 2-year contract, they get paid when they hit the target and so on. But right now, they're starting to integrate the company much faster. So that's another kind of new thesis, which is getting, you know, developed as a building platforms.
Interesting. So it's interesting, I've kind of set through the LBO model, maybe if it's too overly leveraged and driving that, and then we are seeing increasingly the roll up deals, the buy and build deals, and that becoming really popular around a lot of private equity firms to, as you put it, I like that.
Exactly.
And drive that. It's really interesting. What do you love about private equity and what do you hate about private equity, please? Or what do you dislike? Sorry, we don't use the word hate anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what I like about private equity is, you know, it's like in all of finance, like you have hedge funds and all that. Many of the other aspects, it's still a lot of taking kind of bets, right? Which is just to gaming the market and so on. Here, you're buying real businesses, you're transforming real business. And you're taking time to transform every single business, which adds to the overall productivity of human race. I think that's a huge, and they know how to run, make these companies very lean and effective. And because of that, we are also starting to see even the companies which are not owned by private equity following private equity playbooks to make themselves more efficient. So they have now taught companies and industry how to be lean and more efficient. And that's one. And second is corporate governance practices. When the private equity buys a company, they bring in very high level of governance because of the limited partner they work with and so on, and oversight. So the company's operations gets much, much better when they go IPO. So it's just really transforming real businesses and creating real value. I think that's what, you know, really excites us for working with private equity firms. What I think, like I said before, they could be a little bit like VC on the growth side, be comfortable with uncertainties. How do you marry the, you know, focus on efficiency as well as the uncertainty on growth? I think that's, we would like to see that, a little bit more of that.
So,
and what are your influences, Parry? What do you read? What do you watch? What do you listen to? What would you recommend that others check out?
Yeah, sure. I watch a lot of, unlike the 2022 was a great year. We had shows around Spotify. You have, you know, what, Succession. There's shows around Uber and Theranos and all of that, right? So it's great learning, lots of interesting shows coming from a lot of games. A good thing about OTT, it's creating enough content for the long tail. And right? I would consider myself long tail looking at business shows. That's awesome. And I like to read more, you know, autobiographies of very successful entrepreneurs.
And if anybody wishes to reach out to you post this conversation, Barry, how best do they contact you, please?
They should reach out on my LinkedIn. That's probably the best way to reach.
Perfect. We'll put that in the show notes. Well, Barry, thank you very much for joining us. Really appreciate your insight. You leave us with lots of value for private equity professionals and, of course, portfolio executives. And there's some bits and pieces to really think about and also act immediately. So thank you for that.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks for the invite. And enjoy the conversation with you.
Excellent. We're pleased to hear that. And as always, thank you very much to everybody listening. Of course, should you ever need support with private equity professionals or further executive hiring, please do reach out to us at Royal Selection. But till the next time, if you haven't already done so, please do subscribe and check out the next podcast, which will be coming out in 2 weeks. But till then, keep smashing it. And thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Private Equity Podcast on www.raw-selection.com.